Okay, morning everyone. We're doing Parshas Chaya Sarah, page 106. Essentially, the Parsha is divided into three parts. The death and burial of Sarah, the Shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka, and then at the end, it's the end of Avraham Avinu's life, of what he does. He takes another wife, or he remarries Hagar, and the other children that he has, and what happens to the descendants of Yishmael. So that's the central structure of the parasha. What I want to do is, I want to read through go into a few little psukim in the first section, do a couple of things in the second section, and then come back and share with you a thought that sort of runs through everything in the parasha, or a lot of things in the parasha. So let's have a look at the first pasuk. This is page 106, verse 1, pasuk aleph. Vayiyu chaye Sarah. Are we getting fed today, right? Look at that. Special occasion?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is just leftover
from something. Oh, great. Okay. Thank Sarah, and it was the life of Sarah was 100 years, the Esrim Shana 20 years, the Sheva Shanim 7 years. Shnei Chaye Sarah, these are the years of the life of Sarah. Of course, we know the famous Rashi, who brings from our rabbis of why it is that the Torah divides up the 100 and the 20 and the 7. Why doesn't it just say 127? Why does it say after each one Shana years, right? And Rashi tells us because essentially Sarah's life was amazing at every single juncture. And when she was 100, she was as clean, as pure as from sin as a 20-year-old, because 20 is an age where people start to be punished for heavenly matters, for heavenly sins, etc. When she was 20, she was as beautiful as she was 7. And then Rashi says, Kulan Shavin Latova, they were all equal, they were all good. Which is just, I don't want to go into this in too detail, but it's interesting actually what that actually means. Like, what does it mean? When she was 100, she was as she was 20 or she was 7. We know that Sarah actually went through ups and downs in her life. It actually wasn't so smooth. But it's more about what she did with her life. In other words, to her, it was all equal. Nothing actually made a difference. And she gave tremendous purpose and meaning to every single stage of her life. That's sort of one perspective. Okay. Next part it says, Vatoma Sarah, and Sarah died, the Kiryas Arba, in the place called Kiryas Arba. The village of four. Rashi says it was called the village of four because there were, well, first of all, there were four giants who lived there. And secondly, the Torah is telling us something to do with the future because ultimately there would be four couples buried there. Adam and Chava, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. He, Hebron, which is Hebron, Be'eretz Canaan, which is the land of Canaan. Vayavai Avraham, and Avraham came, Lispoid L'Sarah, to eulogize Sarah, V'lifkoisa, and to cry for her. You see, of course, in the word V'lifkoisa, there's a small chaf. The Balaturim and other Mefarshim comment why there's a small chaf in the word Lifkoisa. Some say that his crying was somewhat measured, somewhat limited, because it wasn't a tragic death. She was old and lived a good life, etc., etc. And he acknowledged that even in the crying for her. Others say that if you take out the chaf, as would suggest, if you have a small chaf, it looks like it's without the chaf. It actually makes ulavita for her daughter, because Avraham Avinu actually had a daughter who also passed away at the same time, and he came to cry for not only for Sarah, but ulavita and for her daughter as well. Okay. Vayakom Avraham, and Avraham got up ma'al p'nei meitzah in front of his dead body, v'dabar el b'nei ches lehem, and he spoke to the children of ches. And now we have the whole story of Ephraim Hachiti, Ephraim the judge at that time who lived in the city of Hebron. Originally, everyone was very enthusiastic about giving Avraham Avinu the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the cave to bury Sarah. Avraham Avinu specifically wanted to pay for it. At the end, of course, Ephraim enthusiastically agreed to receiving payment and gave this ridiculous price of 400 shekel, over la secher, 400 silver shekel, which Avraham paid in full. I don't know if I ever told you the story. I once heard from my grandfather, I'll show him the story of the Arizal and the Alshich, Parshas Chayesara. there was a time in Tzfas where great men lived in Tzfas altogether. It was an amazing time. The Arizal lived there, the Shalom, the Beis Yosef, the Al-Sheikh. And each one had a different role. The Al-Sheikh was known to be someone who, his drush, his power of oratory, so to speak, and interpretation of the Pasuk was tremendous. And you look in his Sfarim, you'll see it's there. The Arizal was the Kabbalist, the Beis Yosef was the Halachist, etc. The Al-Sheikh would deliver every Shabbos afternoon, he would deliver a big drasha, a parsha shir. One time it was Parshas Chayisara, and as he began his drasha, the Arizal walked in with all his Talmud, with all his disciples, which was a tremendous honor for the Al-Sheikh. And the Al-Sheikh felt good, and he started to give his drasha. And it started to be a very, very good drasha, and it was going extremely well. It was like one of the best, you know what I'm saying? And suddenly, in the middle of the drasha, the Arizal picks himself up and walks out. And obviously, if he walked out, his Talmudim walked out as well. So the Al-Sheikh felt a little bad. So he decided afterwards he was going to talk it through. Maybe he felt a bit awkward about it. So he wanted to talk it through with the Arizal. And he said, he wanted to understand what was it all about. Why did he come and why did he leave? What's going on? So the Arizal told him, and I guess on his level, he taught him an important lesson. He said like this. He says, I want you to know, why did I come? It wasn't only for you. I came because the Gemara says, when you say over a Divrei Torah in the name of people, you talk about people in the Parsha or people in the Gemara, whatever the case is, the people are actually there. It's not like you're just talking about something abstract, they're actually there. So when you give Avraham, when you give a shir about Avraham and Sarah, Avraham Avinu is there. So I came, l'kavod Avraham Avinu, I came in honor of Avraham Avinu. But you should know like this, he says, that when you speak about, everyone was there, all the players, Avraham Avinu was there. And Ephron was there, the guy who sold him the caver. Everyone was there. He says, in the middle of the drasha, he says, it was going so well that you started to feel on your level a little bit of arrogance, a little bit of gaiva. So he says, Avraham Avinu doesn't tolerate that. So Avraham Avinu left. So he said, just to stay with Ephron, I wasn't terribly interested. So just me and Ephron didn't like that. That's why I left. Anyway, I'm sure there's more to the story. It's probably a deeper story. He probably wanted to teach him a lesson, whatever the case was. That's the story. Okay. Now, there's a Rashi. If you look in Pasuk Test, that's a little in the ninth Pasuk, ninth verse 9. When Avraham Avinu asked for Ephron, he says, "V'yiten li esma'ara samachpeila." Please, he says, make an appointment with me for Ephron. He will give me the ma'ara samachpeila, will give me this cave, asher loy, which belongs to him, asher biktzei sadeo, which is in the edge of his field. The Kesef Mola Yitnanali says he will give it to me with a full price. I'm willing to pay a full price. B'soichachem la'achuzas kover among you for a piece of real estate that I can bury, Sarah. So Rashi says, what's this Kesef Mola story? What does it mean with full price? So Rashi says, kol shavir, I want to pay its entire worth, its entire value. I don't want to get a discount, I want to pay its entire value. And then Rashi says, v'chein David Amar, David HaMelech also said, Aravna, to a person called Aravna, the Kesef Mole with full price. What's Rashi making a reference to? Rashi making a reference to the time of David HaMelech. You know, David HaMelech lived a few hundred years after the Jews had entered the land of Eretz Yisrael. But until the time of David HaMelech lived, the Beis HaMikdash wasn't yet built. Because when Yehoshua came into the land of Eretz Yisrael with the Bnei Yisrael, he conquered the land of Eretz Yisrael but didn't finish. Right? The Jews didn't finish the whole job. And the bottom line is, for a few hundred years, the entire Eretz Yisrael remained unconquered. David HaMelech was the one to complete the wars. And one of the things that David HaMelech did is he conquered Yerushalayim from the Yevusites, the Yevusim, right? When he conquered Yerushalayim, David HaMelech made his mission that he wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, and he laid the plans, and in fact, the actual building of the Beis HaMikdash he wasn't permitted to do, because God said to him that you're a man of war, and the Beis HaMikdash is a house of peace, so he wasn't able to do that, but he laid all the groundwork. One of the things he did was, he went and bought the spot, Temple Mount. He bought it from the person who owned it. Who was the person who owned it? He was a Yevusite. It was someone called Aravna HaYevusim. Right? Aravna the Yevusite. So you want some cups? Aravna HaYevusi. This Aravna HaYevusi owned a barn, and that barn was on Temple Mount. And David HaMelech collected money from all the tribes and he bought it from Sarav Mayus. And there it also says the expression of the Kesef Mole, he paid a full price. Right? So So it's interesting why Rashi would bring that. In other words, Avraham Avinu paid a full price for Hebron, and David HaMelech paid a full price for the Temple Mount. Why do they pay a full price, and why is it necessarily brought together? But the pshat is because the two things are actually connected. In fact, it's connected to a third thing. But let's take these two for the moment. Hebron and Temple Mount actually belonged to Avraham Avinu and David HaMelech respectively, without paying for it altogether. Because Avraham Avinu makes reference to this himself. He says, when he comes to them, his introductory remarks are to the Bnei Chais. He says, Geir v'toyshav. I'm a ger, I'm a stranger, but I'm a resident. In other words, take your pick. Either I'm a stranger and treat me with hospitality and treat me nicely, or I'm a resident. And if I'm a resident, I'll take this by force because it actually belongs to me. Hashem has given me the land. It's my land. I actually can take this al pidin, so to speak. Nevertheless, he insists on paying for it. David HaMelech was the same thing. David HaMelech came to the Temple Mount. He didn't need to buy it from Rabbi Musa. He just conquered the Holy Yerushalayim. It already now belonged to the Jews through the concept of kibbush. In fact, we know that one of the ways that the possession of Eretz Yisrael took place when the Jews entered the land was this idea of kibbush Eretz, conquering the land. Right? But nevertheless, because of the importance of the spot, David HaMelech wished to pay for it. Why? When you conquer something, at the end of the day, it's yours, you've taken it by force, but you haven't actually removed completely the connection of the person who was there beforehand. You've taken it away, but you've taken it away by force and not willingly, which means the person's desire is still there. So on some level, on some subtle level, the connection of that spot to the original owner still exists. Right? When Avraham Avinu bought Hebron, he bought the Maaret Machpelah, as we'll see later with regard to a different concept, Maisa Ova Siman Labanim, whatever happens to the forefathers is a siman, it was a sign to what was going to come in future generations to the Bnei Yisrael. Right? Avraham Avinu buying Maaret Machpelah was a symbol, it was a model for the ownership of the Jewish people over the land of Eretz Yisrael. And what Avraham Avinu wanted to demonstrate is that there's such an ownership that the ownership that the Jews have of Eretz Yisrael is a deep ownership. And it's an ownership where no one has, not only no one has it practically, but no one else has any connection to it. It's not a lesson that everyone understands today properly, but but nevertheless, that's the truth. Yeah. And therefore, he insisted, he says, I could take this by force. I could take it legally with a legal battle. But I don't want to. I want to take it bekesef, but bekesef mole. Not only do I want to pay for it, I don't want a discount. Because again, the discount is then you're left with the goodwill. If you buy a house with a discount, the original owner thinks he's got a portion of the house now forever. Because you know he sold you for a discount. Don't forget, you bought it from me for a discount. He said, I don't want a discount. Which was fine, because Ephron obliged. He didn't give him a discount. In fact, he overcharged him. But the concept of kesef mole was to buy it at its full price so that I remove the connection that everyone else had to it completely. Rashi says that's exactly the concept that David HaMelech did. David HaMelech walked into Yerushalayim. He didn't need to buy the Temple Mount. Right? But the Temple Mount needed to be also, in his times, the model and the center of the Jewish inhabitants of the land of Eretz Yisrael. And that's why David HaMelech comes to this guy, who wasn't actually a bad guy, but he just sold it to David HaMelech, and he buys it from him, a Rav Na'ivusi, the Kesef Mole, again with a full price, no discount, to remove the connection completely. Right? The I think I pointed out before, the amazing thing, of course, is that there's three places in Eretz Yisrael that were bought. Hebron, we speak about this week's parasha, the Temple Mount, and Shechem, right, which were the three most contested places today in Eretz Yisrael. Right, which is an interesting concept. So that's what goes, because obviously the objection and the contesting of our ownership of the land of Eretz Yisrael is a very deep thing. It's not just a matter of occupation or who's there, etc., etc. It goes to the very, very core of the right to the land of Eretz Yisrael and the biblical right to the land of Eretz Yisrael. And because the biblical right, the biblical right to the land of Eretz Yisrael is so deep, and it's most reflected in the places that were bought. See, that's the concept. Our right to Eretz Yisrael is actually reflected dafka in the places that we bought, because that was taken on all levels, conquered, inhabited, bought. All previous connection was fully removed on all levels, and that's why those are the three places that actually reflect our right to Eretz Yisrael in general in the deepest way, and that's obviously why those three places are dafka the most contested places. So that's an interesting kind of concept. Okay. So that's the basis of. By the way, how did Avraham Avinu know that Moras HaPelah was such a special place? So it goes back to last week's parsha. There's an interesting medrash that Avraham Avinu, when the Malachim came, he was going to prepare for them a meal. As you know, he prepared for them calves. He shefted the three calves in order to serve them tongue and mustard, right? Which was considered a very big delicacy. I don't think you can get it. Can you get tongue in the butcher though? Can you buy it? That's very, very good. As a kid, I had it all the time. But anyway, on Yontif, I know it was also considered among traditional Jewish houses, always considered a Yontif a delicacy. But anyway, so, and it does not everyone's a cup of tea, but nevertheless. So Avraham Avinu wanted to shecht three calves. So it says in the Medrash that one of the calves ran away. And Avraham Avinu had to run after it. He was 3 days after his bris milah, but he was enthusiastic to serve the guests a proper meal. So he pursued it, and the thing ran. This calf ran and ran and ran. Avraham Avinu followed it, and it ran into a cave, and that was the cave of Moras HaMachpelah. When Avraham Avinu went into the cave of Moras HaMachpelah, following, trying to chase this calf, he suddenly smelt the scent of Gan Eden. And he realized that's where Adam and Chava are. And Adam and Chava were buried in Moras HaMachpelah. And that's why he knew that has to be the burial site of the Ovis, of the forefathers, and that became the place of Adam and Chava and the patriarchs and Maria and Sarah, Rivka, and Leah. Anyway, okay, that's the first part of the parasha. The second part of the parasha, let's just read a few psukim. Talks about the shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka. So it's page 108, two lines from the bottom. It says, Pasuk Aleph, the Avram Zaken Bo Bayamim. Avram was old. Bo Bayamim, he came with all his days. Yeah. The Hashem Beirach Es Avram Bakoil. And Hashem had blessed Avraham with everything. And this was the introduction to this Pasuk. What does it mean, Bo Bayamim? He came with his days. That doesn't mean he. If it says he was old, what does it mean he came with his days? It means he had a full life, that Avraham Avinu could account for every day. Every day was filled with something. So he calls his servant Eliezer and he tells him to go and find a shidduch for Rivka. The reason is because Yitzchak wasn't permitted to leave the land of Eretz Yisrael because he was considered a sacrifice. He was considered a korban after the story with Akedah. So Eliezer had to go and find a wife from Avraham Avinu's family in Haran. Naram Narayim, whatever. Eliezer is nervous. What happens if the girl doesn't want to come? So, and also as Rashi says, he hinted that actually he really wanted to marry his own daughter after Yitzchak. And Avraham Avinu was insistent. He says, "Don't worry, you'll find Hashem will help you. If not, you're free from your oath." Right. So he goes and he takes Rivka. The whole story creates a sign. If she's kind, if she'll give water to him and his camels, right? You all know the story. Later on, if you have a look, just. All the way at the end, I'll just show you. Because the story is told at great length and the details are repeated. Right? Okay. Just have a look at page 118. Second to last line. Pasuk Samach Beis, verse 62. So he's traveling back, Eliezer's traveling back with Rivka. Yitzchak bo mi boi be'er l'chai ra'i. And Yitzchak is coming from a place called Be'er l'chai ra'i. Yerushu beretz ha'negev, because he was dwelling in the south of the country. Vayetze Yitzchak, turn over the page, Vayetze Yitzchak l'suach basadeh. And Yitzchak went out to pray in the field. This was mincha, this was Yitzchak bein mincha. Lifnes orev as it's coming to evening. He picks up his eyes and he sees, there are camels coming. So now Rivka picks up her eyes, she saw Yitzchak, and she sort of fell off the camel. What does it mean? She fell off, she means she like slipped off the camel. She said to the master, to the servant, who's this man coming to meet us? And the slave said, who Adoni, that's my master, and it was Yitzchak. She took the veil and she veiled herself, which is one of the sources of the badekim that we have today in the wedding, right? By Sapor Ever Yitzchak, and the slave told Yitzchak all the things that he did, he told nothing. Then it says, Yitzchak brought Sarah back to her tent. Vayikach es Rivka, and she took Rivka. He took Rivka. Vati lo le isha, and she became his wife. Vayeaveh ani lavda. Vayinochem Yitzchak achare imoy. And it was that point that Yitzchak became comforted after his mother. Yeah. Rashi says, what does that mean? Because he took her into Sarah's tent. So Rashi says that there were three miracles that happened in Sarah's tent that stopped after she passed away. Three miracles were, there was an onon kosher al ha'il, there was a cloud that was connected to the tent, symbolizing the blessing of the tent, the shechina. Bracha mutsuya ve'issa, there was a special blessing in the dough, it was fresh and it always lasted and had enough. And ner dolluk me'erev Shabbos l'erev Shabbos, when Sarah would light Shabbos candles, the candle then would last the whole week miraculously, like the Hanukkah miracle. So it should light only for Shabbos, but it would last all week. Those are the three miracles that happened in Sarah's tent. When she passed away, it stopped. Yitzchak brought Rivka to Sarah's tent, and as soon as that happened, the miracles began once again. And at that point, he became comforted after his mother. It was a comfort for him, and she became his wife. Okay? However, we need to understand the significance of what is it about those three miracles, and why dafka those three miracles happened to Sarah, and what was the point, and why they came back with Rivka, and we're going to understand it in a bit of a broader context. So, in order to understand all these things, let's actually go back now to the beginning of the parasha. So I just wanted to do a few pesukim in these various parts, and then let's understand now the whole parasha. There's a concept that's spoken about in the Ramban at length that says, Maisa Ovoi Simen Labonim. I mentioned this before. That what happened to the forefathers is a simen, a sign of what was going to happen to their children. Right? Now there's two ways to understand that. One way to understand that is that what happened to them is like became like a sign, was a simen of what could have taken place. That was what happened later to their forefathers, all hinted in their life story. But actually we know that it's much deeper than that. It's not that history can be traced back and hints can be found in the lives of the Avos and the Imois to symbolize our story. It's actually the other way around. It's Maisa Avos, what happened to the Avos, what happened to our forefathers. Siman Labonim is a sign, meaning created the history of their descendants. It shaped the future destiny. Whatever happened to them became the shaping force, the molding force, what was going to come to Bnei Yisrael following it. And we see many, many, many examples of this. On a general level, however, we see this in the following concept. The difference between the Avos and the Imois, the fathers and the mothers, the patriarchs and the matriarchs. We are told that the Avos represent the neshama and the Imois represent the body. So it's actually a relationship between soul and body. Right? We see this by Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov, Rachel and Leah. Right? On different levels, in different ways, but generally speaking, the forefathers, the Avraham was the neshama, was the soul. The Sarah was the body. What does that mean on a deeper level, in a more general level? What that means is that the Avos' role was to generate spirituality. Right? They were soul-type people. They were people of the soul. In other words, their concept, they were very, very in tune with the spiritual energy of the world. They were very in tune with the will of Hashem. They were very in tune with Torah study. They were very in tune with the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but in a completely spiritual context. Right? The ability of the Imois, the ability of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, was to translate that and apply it in the world of the physical, in the real world, in the practical world, which wasn't so much the ability of the Avos. Okay? And that's generally the concept of male and female. We know this, we spoke about it when we did a Thursday morning series. Right, the male energy of the world is creativity, to create new concepts, but they dissipate, they're not always applied. The female force is to process it, bring it down, and to apply it and make it work. We see this very clearly by the case of Sarah and Yishmael, the whole story of last week's parasha, where Yishmael is expelled from the house of Avraham Avinu, and Avraham Avinu finds this very difficult. And it has to come to a time where Hashem actually says to Avraham Avinu, "Kol aser toimer alecha Sarah shma b'kayla." Whatever Avraham Avinu, whatever Sarah does, it tells you, do you have to listen to it. Why? What actually happened? What happened was like this: Avraham Avinu saw Yishmael in a different world. He didn't see Yishmael in the world of practice, in the practical world. He saw Yishmael in potential, because that's the male thing. Everything is in potential, right? He saw Yishmael in his source, in his origin. Everything has a spiritual origin. Everything, even things that evolve into the negative, into negativity in this world, have a spiritual good. Now, we're told this in Kabbalah about everything that happens in this world. Everything physical has a spiritual origin. And the spiritual origin is always pure. Right? Parai has a spiritual, is a spiritual parai. That's talked about in Kabbalah. Esav is a spiritual Esav. In all of these things, its spiritual origin is always positive. Different things evolve in different ways. Some things evolve positively, some things evolve negatively. Right? Yishmael, in his spiritual origin, was fantastic. And that's what Avraham Avinu saw. Same thing with Yitzchak next week. Yitzchak wants to give Esav the brachas because he doesn't see Esav. He sees Esav in the spiritual Esav. He sees Esav, the good Esav. Rivka has to tell him that, no, Esav, it has to go through Yaakov. Right? So that's not the way it's processed. Same thing with Sarah. Avraham Avinu sees the spiritual Yishmael. Sarah is the one that's able to say no. You have to expel him, because in the world of practice, it's not going to work. It's not working. In the world of practice, for Yitzchak to survive, for Am Yisrael to survive, Yishmael has to be removed. Right? So that's the relationship between the guf and the neshama, the body. We're not talking about a body, an animalistic body. We're talking about the body, meaning the ability to refine the body. Yes, Sarah is able to take inspiration from Avraham Avinu. The body takes inspiration from the neshama. The guidance, the spirituality generated by Avraham Avinu, but the application is Sarah. Right? That's the general thing. Now, this is these two energies, these two concepts, the concept of the spiritual forces and the application of spirituality, are two components that run through our life and run through the whole concept of serving Hashem. Right? We have Shabbos and during the week, for example. Right? Shabbos is a spiritual day, which is a day dedicated to spirituality. But then the kunst, the challenge is to take the Shabbos and let it impact into the week. Right? So we have this concept all the time. And the model created, the marriage between those two forces, the coexistence, the cooperation between the force of spirituality and the ability to apply it to the world of practice, is the marriage that has to take place. And it's the marriage that began between Avraham and Sarah. How does it work? And whatever happened to Avraham and Sarah then becomes the model of how it works with us. And we see it reflected in last week's parasha, and we see it reflected in this week's parasha as well. So last week's parasha begins with the first mitzvah that's recorded in the Torah given to Avraham Avinu, where Hashem communicates to Avraham Avinu, Lech Lecha. Right? What is that? What is that? What does that mean in this context? It's the command that Hashem gives the soul to Lech Lecha, to journey, to come down to the body. The Pirkei Avos says, Bal Charchach Atochai, against your will you live. Why? Because the Neshama doesn't want to come. The Neshama knows the challenges of coming to this physical world. The Neshama knows that in this world it will be trapped, possibly, and won't find its full expression, and won't be in the spiritual and godly and divine environment that it finds itself before it comes to this world. So the Neshama doesn't want to go. It's a test. It's a challenge for the Neshama. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to say, Lech Lecha, you have to go. Me'atzecha, from the spiritual land, from the place where you originate, and you've got to go Ela Oretz, you've got to go down to the physical world, you've got to unite with the body, you've got to unite with Sarah. That's the marriage between Avraham and Sarah. So the Neshama goes, right, and works together with Sarah, and it works. But then it comes a time where there's tremendous challenges, and there comes a time where there's tremendous challenges where they have to go into the land of Mitzrayim, right? And I'm going to go back a little bit to last week's parasha, because this is really important. And suddenly, there's this problem where Avraham Avinu turns around to Sarah and says, Imri no achosia, please say you're my sister. Don't say you're my wife, say you're my sister. Right? In order that it'll be good for me. So we know the famous question, well, first of all, what's this? I mean, Avraham Avinu is saving his skin, he's looking out for his own benefit. What's actually happening, right? But I'm going to take it in the same context of what we're explaining and explain the whole thing differently. It's a conversation that happens between the neshama and the guf, between the soul and the body, when a Jew goes into Golos. Right? We all are in Golos. The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. The Jews have been in Golos for 2,000 years. It was previous Golos. It was Golos Mitzrayim. It was Golos Babel. But there's two experiences of a Jew. There's an experience of the Beis Hamikdash where everything's going fine, and there's an experience of Golos where God is hidden, where God is concealed, where godliness is not obvious, and to serve Hashem is challenging. So the neshama turns to the body and says the following. You should understand like this. that when we go into Golus, the neshama isn't affected. The neshama doesn't go into Golus. The neshama doesn't lose its spirituality. What does suffer when a Jew goes into Golus is the relationship between the neshama and the body. That suffers. When God is obvious, when there's a Beis HaMikdash, when there's miracles, there's a marriage between the body and the soul. The body, they cooperate together. The neshama is able to express itself through the body. There's learning of Torah, there's study of mitzvahs. It's going unbelievably well. When a Jew goes into Golus, when there's a situation of adversity and oppression and general spiritual or physical Golus, the neshama retains spirituality, but it's not able to express itself through the body. And there's tremendous challenges against the service of Hashem, and the relationship between the guf and the neshama starts to weaken. The body is not so sensitive to spirituality, it doesn't want to fulfill mitzvahs, the neshama is frustrated, there's tension. Right. So the neshama has to say to the body, listen, we need extra strength. We need to strengthen this relationship. And I think I've explained this concept before. So he says to the neshama, the neshama says to the body, up till now we were husband and wife. Now we have to become brother and sister. Why? Because what's the difference between husband and wife and brother and sister? Husband and wife, there's a tremendous fundamental difference between the two relationships. Both have tremendous love. There's a love which exists between siblings, and there's a love which exists between husband and wife. What's the difference? The difference is that the love between husband and wife is much more obvious, much more intimate, and much more emotional, much more full-blown. Right? But it's also less intrinsic. Because it's a love that if it's not nurtured, if there's separation, if there's a problem, it could fall apart very easily. The love between family is less obvious. It doesn't work on that full-blown emotional scale, but it's more intrinsic. Brother and sister can be in two different continents, but they're still brother and sister. Bottom line is there's an unbelievable relationship. Right? In times of Golus, it's hard to have that emotional love, the emotional relationship. It's hard to have the marriage between the body and soul. But then we have to dig deeper and reveal a different, more intrinsic relationship. And that's the relationship between brother and sister. Which means that it's not so obvious, but it's solid. It works together. Maybe it's not so enjoyable. Maybe it's not something that everyone experiences such pleasure out of, but it's intrinsic. So the neshama knows its commitment to the body. The body knows its relationship to the neshama. They work together, although there's not that revealed love between the two because it's Golus. Right, so that's why he says to Imunah Chesiyat. But he says to her like this. He says, if you do this, if we succeed through Golus, if we can spiritually survive and still work together and serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and do mitzvahs throughout the Golus period, maybe we won't feel the same as we did before, but we will have the Mesiras Nefesh and we'll serve God just like before, it'll be good for me. What does that mean? It means like this. That notwithstanding that the Neshama does not want to come to the body. It's a lech lecha, it's a test. The first mitzvah given to the neshama is you have to go, you don't have a choice. Hashem forces the neshama down into the body. Right? But at the end of the day, the neshama comes to realization that through working with the body and serving Hashem in the context of the physical world with all its challenges, the neshama, as spiritual as it was before it came down here, the neshama becomes higher. The neshama is elevated. The experience that the neshama has in this world, it's so amazing for the neshama, it's an opportunity that could never be achieved in Gan Eden, that the neshama becomes stronger. Although it was all spiritual before, although the neshama wasn't lacking anything spiritually before it came here, but it gains from the experience. And that's why the same Pirkei Avos, the same Mishnah that says, Bal Korchach Atachai, that against your will you live, it also says, Bal Korchach Atameis, against your will you die. Because at the end of the life, the neshama doesn't want to leave. It didn't want to come here, but doesn't want to leave either because it realizes the tremendous opportunity that was here. The famous story with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon passed away on the third day of Chol HaMoed Sukkos. Says on his deathbed he took hold of his tzitzis and he started to cry. And he said, because leaving a world that you can't do this there. You can for a few pennies but take something physical and turn it into a mitzvah. Right? It's something only can be done in this world. It's an opportunity that only exists in this world. Yeah? But they say a joke that there was once a neshama. There was two neshamas. One was leaving this world, one was coming down. And they met halfway. And the neshama coming down, asked the neshama coming up, he says, no, tell me, give me a bit of a preview. Tell me what's Tetzach on that world. He says, yeah, you know, it's an amazing world. It's an amazing world. He says, there, you know, the neshama up there learns Torah, right? So it learns about the mitzvah of tzitzis. but it can't perform the mitzvah, because if you don't perform mitzvahs, that's with physical things. You have to elevate the physical. So neshama going up says, in that world down there, you know, you learned about tzitzis, you understand the spiritual esoteric meanings behind the world of tzitzis. In that world, you can do the mitzvah for a few pennies. You can actually buy tzitzis and you can fulfill a mitzvah. So neshama hears this, he's amazed. He says, it's unbelievable. So he starts to run. So neshama going up calls to him and he says, but don't run so fast. He says, because until you get those few pennies, your neshama can go out. He says, you can lose your neshama before you can get those few pennies to buy the tzitzis. Anyway. So the bottom line is the neshama gains, right? Which is then reflected in this week's parsha. So let's go back to a pasuk where we see the second pasuk of the parsha again on page 106. Right? I'll explain to you how this pasuk is understood on a deeper level. You know, the Torah can be read on many levels. I'll show you one of the commentaries of how it's read on a deeper level. Yeah.
Is neshama considered in this world at conception or at birth?
Sorry, what?
Is the neshama considered to have come down, like a conception, or when the baby?
Ah, very, very good question. Fantastic question. The way it works is as follows: the neshama has a spiritual origin somewhere in Shemayim, in some spiritual world, right? Before it can come down to this world, it also needs to be developed. So there's a simultaneous gestation period that happens for the body and for the neshama, but separately. So the neshama that a baby has is designated at conception. But then it goes through its own pregnancy. It goes through its own 9 months of development. To become down, of developing its, all of its strengths and components to be able to come down to the body. Where at the same time, the physical body also develops. The Gemara says that when a baby is in its mother's womb, it says, Neir Doluk Al Roshay. There's a candle that burns Al Roshay on top of its head. And a Malach teaches it the entire Torah. Right? We know that concept, yeah? What does it mean there's a candle burning on top of its head? Obviously, it doesn't mean physically. That would be a little bit dangerous, right? So obviously, it's a spiritual concept. And the Mepharshim explain, the ner, the candle refers to the neshama, to the soul. But that's what it means, that ner doluk al roishay, the candle is burning on top of its head, because the neshama doesn't integrate with the body during the 9 months of pregnancy. What's happening is, it's burning on top of its head. It's separate to the body, going through its own journey as the body is. The body is connected to the mother's neshama at that time, receiving its sustenance from its mother, and the neshama is developing on its own. The moment of birth is where the marriage between the guf and the neshama, the body and soul, starts to take place. So when the baby is born, at that point, that's when the neshama enters the body and starts to operate as an independent entity. That's the simcha of birth, really. Right? Now that itself takes stage, it's not fully integrated. For example, the neshama integrates with the body stronger when a name is given. And ultimately, it happens by bar and bas mitzvah. Bar and bas mitzvah, that's when the neshama and the body fully come together. There's a full marriage, they live together, and from then on, they become responsible to live as a proper Jew. Right? So that's the answer to your question. Okay. So let's have a look at the second pasuk. It says, Vatama Sarah, and Sarah died. Bekiryas Arba, in the place of four, he Chevron, right? Which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Vayovay Avram and Avram came to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. So there's an awful lot of detail in this week, in this passage. She died in Kiryas Arba, which was called Hebron, which is Eretz Canaan. First of all, we know that Hebron is in Eretz Canaan. We know that Eretz Canaan is the land of Eretz Yisrael. We know that Hebron is there. Why do we need to know that the place has two names, Kiryas Arba and Hebron? Why all this detail? So the Mepharshim explained like this. That once again, this is the model of the guf and the neshama coming to an end at the end of its life, right? But Thomas Sarah and Sarah died. The body dies, right? The neshama leaves the body. What is the body? Says the pasuk, Kiryas Arba. The body is the physical part of the human being, which is made up of four parts. We know that every person is made up of four components: fire, dust, eish ruach, fire, wind, water, and dust, right? Which he chevron. Which is Chevron. Chevron means that when a person is alive, those four components are joined together. The word Chevron means Chibur, to be joined, connected. Right? So when a person is alive, the four components, the four foundations of human life are joined together. Eish, Ruach, Maim, and Ofra, the fire, the wind, the water, and the dust. Right? When a person dies, it starts to decompose, which means the components, the elements, are separated. When a person is alive, they're together. So Atomah Sarah Bakirias Abbasara dies, the body dies. What's the body? The body is this combination of these four elements. he Chevron that are joined together. The Eretz Canaan, and while it's alive, it's an Eretz Canaan. Now you know what the land of Eretz Yisrael was called Eretz Canaan? Before it was called Eretz Yisrael, it was called Eretz Canaan. The word Canaan actually means a merchant, to do business, transaction, to achieve, to earn. The neshama, when it's in the physical body, while the body is alive, it's an Eretz Canaan. It can earn, it can achieve. It cannot achieve once death takes place. That's why the Vilna Gaon was crying. Right? Because while the neshama is in the body, there's Eretz Canaan. But what happens, this part says, Vatoma sir. But when Sarah dies, when the guf dies, when the body dies, the neshama realizes its loss. The neshama didn't want to come in the beginning, but at the end it realizes. So Vayovay Avram Avinu came, the neshama came to eulogize the body and to cry for her. Because the neshama realizes what it accomplished through the body. And therefore when the body dies, the neshama cries for the body. And by the way, that's a very, very important concept when it comes to our idea of nichum aveilim, of comforting the dead. We know that when you menachem, it says in Gemara, a fascinating thing, when you menachem oval someone, when you comfort a mourner, it says you're not only comforting the mourner, it's a very important thing to know. You're not only comforting the person that's sitting shiva, you're actually comforting the neshama as well. It says the neshama is also found in the place of mourning, and the neshama is also in mourning. Because the neshama also mourns, just like Avraham Avinu says over here. Avraham Avinu cried for Sarah. The neshama mourns its detachment from the body. And the neshama needs comfort as well. And that's why you menachem over when you comfort a mourner, you're actually comforting the neshama as well, which is one of the reasons, there's a whole halachic debate and controversy how you're supposed to comfort a mourner. Because the standard expression is people say, Hamakom yenachem etchem, which means God should comfort you, and you said in the plural. And people say it even they're talking to one person. So some people say it actually should be changed, it's a mistake. And it should be Hamakom yenachem oisfar, should comfort you in the singular. But the minhag is most people continue to say eschem. And one of the reasons is because you're not only comforting the person in the morning, you're comforting the neshama as well. So it's plural, comforting two people. Which is interesting. So that's why. Yeah. So that's the concept of Sarah, of Avraham Avinu crying for Sarah. That becomes the model of our whole way we serve Hashem, that marriage, that cooperation, that integration between the body and the soul. Okay. Now, this concept, the difference between the Ovis and the Mois, is then reflected in the second pasuk we learned about Sarah's tent. Let's go there again. Where was it? Ah, yes. Page 120. Right, so let's look at the pasuk again. It says, Vayivi'el Yitzchak, and Yitzchak brought her Ella, Sarah Imoy, to the tent of Sarah's mother. Vayikach Rivka, he took Rivka, Matila Lisha, she was a wife to him. Vayivay loved her, Vayinochem Yitzchak, Achar Imoy. Yitzchak became comforted after his mother. Yeah. So why? Because Rashi says there were three miracles. The three miracles were the cloud, the cloud of on the oil, the candle lighting that lasted a whole week, and the bracha which was found in the dough. Incidentally, of course, these three things, and it's connected to what we can explain, correspond to the three mitzvahs of a woman, which is the cloud on the tent is the family purity, the mitzvahs of the tent, of dwelling in the tent. We have the mitzvah of Shabbos candles, which is the candle which we're thinking, and also the bracha, the mitzvah of taking challah, which is the concept of bracha matzuyim issa, the special bracha which was found in the dough. The Sacher Tshuva points out that again, this concept of maisa avos siman labanim, right? This whole idea of what happens to the forefathers is a siman to what's coming to the descendants. And he says that the Ramban says that the avos and the imois were elevated, reached tremendous spiritual heights, right? Which then, when the Jews went into Mitzrayim, they lost that madrega, they lost that level. He says when the Jews went out of Mitzrayim and after Matan Torah and they built the Mishkan, the Jews regained the madrega, the level of the Ovos. When did that happen? It happened when they built the Mishkan. He says a very interesting thing. In the Mishkan that the Yidden built in the Midbar, there were also three miracles, which, and amazingly enough, correspond exactly to the three miracles that happened in Sarah's tent. First of all, we know that during the whole time that the Jews were in the desert, one of the clouds of glory, there was an Anan, there was a cloud that was constantly on the Mishkan. In fact, it became the cloud as a symbol and a sign of when to travel or when not to travel. It would lift up and it would rest when they had to travel and camp, etc. Right? Then there was the Shulchan, the table, where they had the 12 showbread, right? I know there was a miracle in the Mishkan, and subsequently in the Beis HaMikdash, that these showbreads were put there on one Shabbos and eaten the following Shabbos, and they were as warm as fresh the next Shabbos as they were the previous Shabbos. Which is the same miracle that happened to Sarah. Bracha Matsuya ala Isra was a bracha that was found in a dove. Right? Same idea. Then also there was the miracle of the menorah. You know, there was a mitzvah to light the menorah every night in the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan. And the way it was done is enough oil was put into the menorah that should last the entire night. In fact, the Gemara says that they used to put the same amount of oil every night, enough to last the nights of Teves. The nights of Teves in the Northern Hemisphere, the longest nights of the year, it's the winter nights. So there would always be enough oil to last that night, right? So, and miraculously what happened was, one of those candles called the Neir Ma'aravi, the Western candle, it's a whole dispute exactly which candle it was, but one of the candles would actually miraculously continue to burn, and it would burn till the next night, until they had to rekindle the menorah for the next day. Right? So that's the third miracle of Sarah, that the Shabbos candles would last from week to week, reflected afterwards in the miracle of the Neir Ma'aravi, the Western candle, would last all night, all day and all night, right? Which was the three miracles. Again, Ma'aravi, Simon, Labonim. But what's the concept of these three miracles? The concept of these three miracles is once again the same concept we said before. It's the power of Sarah not to leave spirituality as a concept, as an abstract, as a spiritual thing, but to bring it down and apply to this world. And that's reflected in all these three miracles, and that's why it was in Sarah's tent, and that was missing when Sarah was gone, and it returned when Rivka came on the scene, and that's why Yitzchak was comforted. The same thing, that's why the neshama is comforted, when it can again reunite with the body, and apply the ruchness, and apply the spirituality. Why? Because what was the concept? The concept, of course, was that the cloud was tied to the tent. In other words, the concept of bringing the Shekhinah, the divine presence, not as only as a spiritual thing, but bringing it down into the tent, into the living quarters, into the home, to elevate the physical surroundings and make it a place where the Shekhinah rests. Right? Same thing with food, the idea of bracha metzuya be'issa, the idea of a bracha being found in the dough, to elevate the dough so that's not just a physical thing, not just food, but it's elevated to a level of kedusha. And the same idea of Shabbos candles, as we said before, the whole concept of Shabbos candles lasting the entire week was the ability to take the kedusha of Shabbos and not leave it at Shabbos. Was to actually take the Kedusha of Shabbos and bring it into the week and apply it during the whole week. So again, those three things are very connected to the whole theme of Sarah. Right? I'll just add two more concepts that express the same idea. You know that there's something called the Dalid Raglei HaMerkava, the four legs of the chariot. Have you heard this concept? Right? You know that it's a Kabbalistic idea. So when Yecheskel, the prophet Yecheskel, it's the Haftorah we read on the first day of Shavuos, where Yecheskel sees a vision. It's called the celestial chariot. Right? He sees the Merkava. It's four, a chariot of carried by four camps, the lion, the eagle, etc. Right? And he prophesies this, and the whole vision which the Yidden saw again at Matan Torah. So we say that the Dalad Raglei HaMerkava, the four legs of the chariot, we know that our forefathers, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, also had this concept of being a Merkava. They were also like a chariot to the Shekhinah. So just like Yecheskel saw this chariot, which became the chariot for which he calls the Adam Sha'al HaKisei, the supernal man, which is God, so too, the Avos, the forefathers, also, they were chariots to Hashem, they were completely subservient to the will of Hashem. But just like Yecheskel saw the four legs of the chariot, it's always asked, what are the four legs of the chariot down here? What is, which tzaddikim, so to speak, are the four legs of the chariot? So we find two versions in Kabbalah. We find sometimes we talk about Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and David HaMelech. Right? That's the fourth leg, is David HaMelech. And sometimes we find that it's Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Rochel. Right? In fact, the month of Iyar, right, the month of Iyar is an acronym for it's Aleph Yud Yud Resh. It's Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Rochel. Right? That's reflected in a whole halachic debate. There was a whole story in a number of hundred years ago. There was a whole debate on how to write the word Iyar in a get. In a divorce document, and there was a whole suggestion that some people, Poskim, said that there cannot be any divorce taking place during the month of Iyar because we're not sure how to write the month. And other Poskim said, no, we know how to write the month. It's definitely with two Yuds. And one of the proofs that was brought was because in Kabbalah, this concept is brought that Iyar stands for Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Rochel. Right? What's the concept? The concept is that Rachel and David Melech are actually connected. They actually one and the same thing. Because this idea that we have on the one hand a concept and then the application of the concept. We have ruchnis, we have spirituality, and then the ability to apply that spirituality to the world of practice. That concept is very much connected in David HaMelech, and it's very much connected in Rachel. Why? David HaMelech was a melech, he was a king. Now, you know, we've done this before in other cases where we say that a person is governed by 10 powers, right? 3 intellectual, Chacham bin Adas, 6 emotional, Chesed, Gvurah, Tiferes, etc. And the last one is Malchus, the idea of leadership, the idea of kingship, right? And we say that the difference between the 6 emotions and Malchus is 6 emotions are always considered the masculine energy of a person, and Malchus is the feminine aspect. Because Malchus, what Malchus does is, it doesn't create on its own, what it does is it receives and processes the emotions from the first 6 and applies it, right? Sometimes we find a person has very great emotions, great ideas, great concepts, but cannot put it into practice, cannot process it, cannot implement it. The energy of the power of Malchus that we possess is exactly what it suggests. It's always its leadership, the concept of actually leading and applying and making it happen and processing it and implementing it, right? So we know that David HaMelech was the ultimate Melech. He was the concept of Malchus. In fact, that's why David HaMelech didn't operate on his own years. You know that. David HaMelech operated on other Marishan's years. It says he was supposed to be a stillborn. Another Marishan saw that he didn't have any years, so he gave away 70 of his own years. That's why Adam Rishon was supposed to live to 1,000. And David HaMelech, at the end, took 70 years. That's why he lived to 70. And Adam Rishon only lived to 930. Hey, remember that concept? Yeah, famous idea. That's a separate whole another issue to understand what the relationship between Adam and David is. In fact, it's all connected because the word Adam stands for Adam, David, and Mashiach, because Mashiach is also connected to David, comes from David. It's a lot of... I'm rushing through a lot of concepts. Maybe we'll have other times to explore them properly. But... Right, but there's an unbelievable connection there. So, but that's the same idea of Malchus, because what does that mean? David HaMelech was the ultimate Malchus. Malchus means that you take something from something else and you process it and you apply it, which is as great as creating the thing itself. Creation of the thing itself is nothing. To apply it is a much greater ability in a way. It's a deeper ability, right? So David HaMelech is the ultimate Melech. He receives from others. He takes from other Rishonim, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and he puts it into practice. That's why the four legs of the Merkava is Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which are the primary emotions of Echesed, Gvurah, and Tiferes, and then there's David HaMelech to actually make it happen. Right? That's the same idea as Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Rachel, because it's the masculine and the feminine. Out of the four emois, so Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, Rachel is considered the ultimate feminine energy. She took it down, she revealed it, because now we don't have time to go into this, but if Leah and Rachel, Leah is more hidden and Rachel is more revealed, it's thought and speech and whatever, it's a discussion in its own right, but Rachel is the concept of actually bringing it down, actually making it all happen. And that's why, that's that feminine idea of Sarah, going back to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, all the similar things, but Rachel then represents this whole concept, and that's why Rachel becomes the fourth one of the Merkava. Very briefly, I think we have time for one more concept, right? I'll just show you how this is reflected in another concept. Well, because Sarah is buried in Hebron, right? It says that she was buried in Hebron. She was the first one to be buried in Hebron. And that in itself is very, very, very significant. And I'll try and tell you, I think I've shared this concept with you before, but I'll just share it again very briefly so that you think. You know that we have 4 meals of Shabbos. Did I share this idea with you? No? We have Friday night, Shabbos morning, Shabbos Shudas, and Malava Malka. Right? There's also 4 holy cities in Eretz Yisrael, right? Yerushalayim, Tveria, Tzfas, and Hebron, right? And they also correspond to the 4 elements of the person: fire, water, wind, and dust. And if you understand this concept, you'll understand an unbelievable concept of why Sarah, this idea of Sarah being the one to implement it and to bring it down to apply it to the physical world, why she was buried in Hebron and her special connection to Hebron. She was the one through which Hebron was bought, right? So it goes like this very, very briefly. The Friday night meal is the one that corresponds to... And also, the 4 meals of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and David HaMelech, which, again, is the same concept, right? So what does it all mean? The Friday night meal is actually... That's one of the last... It's unbelievable, it's 9 o'clock.
It's amazing.
So the first meal, a Friday night meal, corresponds to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is considered the city of fire. There's always a fire in the Mizbeach. It's a city of tremendous inspiration. People love it. People get very, very inspired there. And it's considered that also corresponds to the meal of Friday night. Friday night we have candles, the idea of fire, and also it's the meal of inspiration, right? The whole idea of Friday night is that we detach from the week, we say goodbye to the week, and we fire up, and we sing songs, and we sit around the Shabbos candles, etc. Shabbos day is the city of Tveria, the city of water. It's a constant of water. Why? First of all, you know that Tveria is a city of water. It's a very calm city. In fact, it's a resort area. And there's a sense of, if you ever went to Tveria, you'll know there's a sense of calmness that happens in Tveria, right? And that's corresponding to the Shabbos day meal, because that's the meal of Torah. You know, a Shabbos day, it's less, just the way it's also structured, it's less song, but it's more Torah. Like the Shurim, the reading of Torah, the more Divrei Torah, the talk about the Parsha, it's more of a Shabbos day thing, right? And that's why, that's the idea of we've had inspiration Friday night, but now we actually have to learn, educate, internalize, and that's the city of water, and that's the concept of it. Shalashudas is the city of Tzfas. Tzfas is the city of wind. If you ever went to Tzfas, you'll know that it's an alternative city. The city of artists, the city of Kabbalists, it's a city of people a step higher than rationale, right? It's a little bit, it's not such a, that's why, like, all alternative stuff happens in Tzfas. Holy and unholy, right? And also, if you ever went to Tzfas, you know that the air is unbelievable. It's a city of, right? And that's why Shalashud is always a toned-down meal, and it's a meal that's less food and more sort of spiritual. It's a spiritual meal, right? And that sort of represents the whole, like, tapping into the spirituality of the soul. Malav Malka is dust. Chevron, city of dust, a very dusty city. It's a cemetery, right? And it's the concept of Malav Malka meal. Why? Malav Malka says, what's Malav Malka? And that goes back to the concept I was going to say before. Malav Malka is, there's a minag, an interesting minag that at Malav Malka is supposed to tell a story. Why? What's the idea of a story? What's the difference between a story of a tzaddik? What's the difference between a story and a Dvar Torah? A Dvar Torah is a concept, right? What's a story? A story is how a tzaddik lived the concept, how he applied the concept, right? Malav Malka is a very important meal. Many people are not aware of this, but actually it's a very, very important meal. Malav Malka is the meal that's the bridge between Shabbos and during the week. It's the meal that allows you to take the Kedusha of Shabbos and apply it to the rest of the week, right? That's why it's the concept of dust. Dust means how you bring it down to the lowest level, how you're able to apply it. It's not spiritual erifery, it's actually how you bring it down and you apply it. And that's why I tell a story, because that's how you do it. And that's why it's the meal of David HaMelech, because David HaMelech is that concept of malchus, that concept of implementation, right? The idea of and that's what's also the right? The concept, that feminine idea. And that's why Sarah is buried in Chevron, because this concept is also the concept of the Imahis. That's why Chevron was brought through Sarah. This idea of taking the spiritual and applying it and bringing it down is the whole idea that we spoke before about what Sarah stands for. And that's all the connection between Sarah and Heaven. So I apologize, I went through these concepts a bit quick, but that's the theme that sort of runs through this whole idea. Thank you. Okay.